Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
In 2001, police in St. Louis, Missouri, suspected that there was a serial killer on the loose. The victims? African-American prostitutes and crack addicts. The MO? Torture and strangulation. However, with no leads, police were in the dark as to how the body count rose. It would take contact from the killer himself for a break in the case, leading authorities to an unassuming suspect with a terrible secret in his basement. This is a story of a ruthless predator with an insatiable appetite for S&M and a penchant for videoing his grisly crimes. This is a case of Maury Travis. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So this case, as you will know from the entry and the short description that I gave you, is shocking. It's a serial killer that many of you may not have heard of. And it also, for me, embodies the traits of the organized kind of killer that we have talked about in previous videos. And certainly as a modern day serial killer, I think it's important to cover this because we think that we've moved on so much in technology. We've moved on so much in investigating that if an organized serial killer was within our midst, then the chances are that we bring them to justice relatively quickly. If that isn't the case, it means that we all need to think deeply about the reality that these predators could and do exist around us and are often chameleons to such a degree that they can literally shapeshift, getting away with the most horrific actions right beneath our noses, sometimes even as neighbours. Between March 2001 and May 2002, multiple women's bodies were discovered, and I mean multiple women's bodies. They were dumped along city streets, they were dumped along country roads in the St. Louis area of Missouri. So these women's bodies are just turning up. Each of them had been strangled to death. Some of them even still had their hands bound or they were still handcuffed. All of the victims that were found, they were known to be prostitutes, sex workers, and drug addicts. Incredibly though, and for me, this is an emotional feeling that I get whenever I cover cases where these individuals who are mothers, daughters, sisters, you know, all these individuals that have great meaning in people's lives or should have great meaning in others' lives, turn up dead, and yet the publicity just doesn't happen. And the reality is, when these bodies are turning up, there's very little covered at the time. Now, authorities, they suspect that they have a serial killer on the loose, but because they have very few leads, and also because of the fact that the women who were being murdered were sex workers or drug dependents, the problem that they also encountered, and that I would imagine meant that this case didn't get put in the priority it deserved, is there's not very much pressure from outside. If you think about some of the big cases all over the world that you've heard of, let's take Gabby Petito recently in America, Madeleine McCann in the UK. These are absolute media frenzies, because there is pressure coming from places, familiarly and community-based, that mean that they have to be given a certain amount of press. It doesn't matter whether you believe that's right or wrong. The point is that when it comes down to sex workers, vagrants, drug dependents, they, for some bizarre reason, don't get the same kind of acknowledgement in the press because families are often not aware and there isn't the same kind of status quo afforded to those individuals because of what they do in their lives. It's a terrible judgment call. Think about the Green River Killer or Samuel Little. These are individuals who worked for decades killing sex workers because they could just get away with it. nobody really cared. But you'd hope in the time frame that I'm talking about now, which is the early 2000s, that we're in a different time politically. We understand the gravity and importance of life, no matter what your job or what your circumstances or what your difficulties are. That means that other bodies turn up because nobody's really that aware of it. So as the months pass, more bodies are found. And in spite of this, police make absolutely no progress in finding the killer. Now, whilst the public were indifferent about this incredibly ruthless human predator that's on the streets, one person was actually growing really impatient with the lack of the media coverage around the killings. And that was the man responsible for them. So the killer is not happy. As far as he's concerned, his work is everywhere on every street corner and no one is talking about it. As far as he's concerned, no one's potentially joining the dots, or even worse, no one cares about his work. And it's worrying him. Remember, organized serial killers in particular, they very much like to be at the center of the investigation. They aren't too happy if they don't feel that people are noticing them, because that psychopathic, sociopathic, and narcissistic consideration that we can apply to them runs within them, and they're wondering why. And in this case, he doesn't like it. Get to the 1st of April, 2001. This is when a partially clothed body of 34-year-old mother of two, Alyssa Greenwade, was found in Washington Park. Mother of two. She was just dumped in an alley. She'd been tied up. They could tell that she'd been beaten. She'd been finally strangled. Now, she'd recently been released from prison and she got back into that cycle of drugs. So she'd ended up dependent and needed to fund her addiction. She had a crack addiction, so she used prostitution to do that. Great to see how the war on drugs is working out there, isn't it? And in the UK, where people literally go to prison, don't get taken off the drugs because you can buy it inside, and then end up back in that cycle. Great rehabilitation there. And in this case, here we have a woman who, because she wasn't afforded the opportunity to change and to be given insight into how she could make a better life for herself through care and compassion within that scenario, she's now dead. On the 4th of April 2001, 34-year-old sex worker was found in a really critical condition in East St. Louis. Instantly, they could see that she'd had ligature marks on her wrists and ankles. Also, they were able to find that she had cocaine and alcohol in her system. She'd been strangled. Then she'd just been dumped by the side of the road, left for dead. Just as if she was rubbish. Now, obviously, the person who thought they'd killed her didn't realise that she was actually alive. But unfortunately, because she has such severe brain damage, as you would imagine, if you have been choked to a point where the person doing it thought you were dead, your brain will have been starved of oxygen, and that will have caused massive impact. And that's before you think about potentially the trauma that she would have suffered being beaten and so on and so forth. Because of that, she couldn't even identify who the attacker was. She couldn't help the police in any way. Then on the 15th of May, 2001, body of 26-year-old Teresa Wilson. She's found in West Alton, also a sex worker. She's been strangled. So we're seeing this consistent theme in this short amount of time. Bear in mind, if you saw this in the news, that all these women are turning up with essentially the same MO, that somebody has strangled them to death, they're all from the same demographic. At the end of the day, you're going to be thinking to yourself, this is a really scary scenario. We need to get warnings out here because these women need to know the kind of type that this killer is looking for and also have some protection for themselves. But this is what's playing out. There is not a loud amplification at this moment in time on the bodies of these women appearing. Get to the 23rd of May, 2001. Naked body of 46-year-old Betty James. She's found in St. Louis. Now, she's been bound with duct tape, also beaten, strangled, and there was a tire track on a leg. So it looks like as well as going through all of those horrible things, her attacker had also ran over her. Again, they found cocaine in her system. So we're seeing this theme that most of these victims are either drug users or are being given drugs. But I think we can probably safely assume they have a dependency issue, makes them even more vulnerable because it means that they are going to go with people that they feel can provide them with either money or substances. Makes them hugely fragile. We get to the 29th of June, 2001. And this is when they find the naked body of 36-year-old Verona Thompson. Again, she's found in West Alton. This is just 16 feet, by the way. 16 feet from where Teresa Wilson's been found. Also, strangled. Drugs found in the system. I don't know about you, but I feel at this moment in time, there should be a national blackout as far as any other news whilst they project the reality of the fact that they have a rampant serial killer raging in this area. Or is it just that we don't care about sex workers and drug dependents? Because you don't really need to be a profiler. You don't need to be that experienced in forensics. You probably could be, I don't know, work experience on the job from college, popping into the station, being taken to a crime scene. In a few weeks, you see the same crime scene playing out and somebody would go, I don't know, I'm only 17, but I'm thinking we've just got a complete serial killer at large with the same MO. I've watched some basic dramas on TV and I've watched a few YouTube videos and we've got a serial killer on the loose. They're going for African-American women who are sex workers and dependents. Do you think we should maybe get it out there? I mean, literally, it drives me mad when we don't have the care and consideration for these people. It is just wrong. It's as simple as that. Get to the 25th of August, 2001. And this is when the body of 50-year-old Yvonne Cruz is found. And again, she's found in East St. Louis. She's got scrapes on her knees. She's got ligature marks on her wrists. And she's been strangled. She's got cocaine in her system. Am I telling the same story again and again? I am, just with different names, which is deeply disturbing, isn't it? We shouldn't be at a position where I can read these names out because we should be caring and we should be investigating in a way that means that these individuals, killers, brought to justice. We get to the 8th of October 2001, and this is when the body of 33-year-old Brenda Beasley, she's found in East St. Louis, and it's really sad how she's found, because it's awful that any of these have been found in the way I've described, but she's literally found amongst a pile of rubbish. That is so psychologically representative to me of what the killer feels about these women. It isn't simply that they are objects to gratify their needs and then can be eradicated, executed, just discarded. Of course, we see that in serial killers, but there's something about the physical action of literally discarding a human body amongst a pile of rubbish that is so representative of the way that individual feels. He's giving a message, isn't it? They are nothing. They are waste. I think that's probably the word that I would associate with it more than anything. They are waste. Now, her eyes and her arms, they'd been taped. And she'd also been struck in the back of her head and she'd been strangled, which is, again, the same MO that we're seeing. Then we get to the 30th of January, 2002. At this point, there's a skeleton of an unidentified woman. She's found near Mascotar, which is basically just over the state border from St. Louis in Illinois. 11th of March, 2002. Skeleton of yet another unidentified woman. She's found near Highland, and that's also just over the border in Illinois. 28th of March, 2002. Yet another skeleton of an unidentified woman found in Columbia, Illinois. I mean, I've been through a substantial list so far, haven't I? Now, the killer, they had actually managed to find some forensic evidence. So semen had been left on two of the victims. Some had been found on Yvonne Cruz's hair and also in the body of Brenda Beasley. And they were actually able to establish that that semen belonged to the same man. So then they use the CODIS database. They put the DNA through it to see whether it alerts them to anybody who's been incarcerated, and they therefore have the DNA of that individual. Sadly, no match is returned. So that's a problem now. Investigators have a really, really big issue. They have a Herculean task, essentially, of just taking random samples from local men. And you can tell, clearly, at this moment in time, they are thinking, we need to act, we need to find out who this is, because he's not going away. And every day that this human being is free, other women are certainly at risk of losing their lives. And ultimately, I imagine that they would be fully aware that this is somebody who has such a rampant desire to kill that we're not talking about one woman potentially being at risk. We're talking about a substantial number of women who are going to lose their lives unless they find him. So they go around trying to get these tests done so that they can pinpoint whoever it will be, but nobody's identified from that. In May 2002, St. Louis Post-Dispatcher reporter Bill Smith, he actually writes a story which is all about profiling the murder of Teresa Wilson. And I have to say, that particular story is, it's a really sympathetic portrayal of the kind of difficult life that she'd had. That she'd had this really tough life and ultimately this untimely death. It was coverage that brought to life that this loss involved a human being. And yet that human being might not.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Made choices that you or I may have made because we were born in different situations, better situations, but they covered it in a way that wasn't deriding who she was at all, quite the contrary. Now, after he does this, gets the letter. We know how our serial killers like to send letters, don't we? So he receives this really unusual looking envelope, and on the front of the envelope, there is a stamp of the American flag and it's neatly stuck upside down. Now, the return address was an S&M website, which was all devoted to bondage. The envelope itself, well, it contained a letter, and that letter was typed in red. Again, very specific, isn't it? Red is not the colour that... I mean, it is the colour you would use if, I don't know, on occasion you run out of the correct ink in your printer. We've all been there, I've done that. But it's not as if you would generally use red. This is expressing the colour of blood, isn't it? It's trying to add shock value to the contents. So this letter allegedly is from the person responsible for the murder that this reporter has covered. Also on the letter was like weird graphic of flowers, rakes, and a beehive that was featured at the top. Now the letter read, "Dear Bill, nice sob story about Teresa Wilson. Write one about Green Wade. Write a good one. And I'll tell you where many others are. To prove I'm real, here's directions to number 17. Search in a 50-yard radius from the X. Put the story in the Sunday paper, like last." I chill when I read that. It always takes my breath away when there are moments that I convey the information that I've just conveyed in tales like this, because these are real letters by real serial killers who took real people's lives. And it's breathtaking to imagine that this isn't a fantasy, this isn't a movie. We're talking about things that actually happened to real people, real time, real life. Now, the body of Alyssa Greenway that had been found a year earlier in Washington Park and enclosed with the letter that had been sent to that reporter was an internet-generated map of part of West Alton, St. Louis. And a spot had been marked with an X. So the police are then alerted, of course they are. And then they go to the dump site because at the end of the day, they've got to check out this lead. I mean, it sounds like it could be real. So they go and they find a body, skeleton remains of a woman hidden in weeds. Now, they've never actually been able to establish the identity of that woman, but the point was genuinely X marks the spot. Also, they were able to find other remains, which was located just across the road from where two other bodies had been found. So at this point, they're taking it super seriously. The content of the letter has led them there. And now they're convinced, yeah, all our worst thoughts are coming true. This really is a serial killer that we've got on our hands. Now, bear in mind at this point, I have absolutely no clue whatsoever to who the killer is. No idea about his identity. But they have got a map and they have got the letter. And this is always intriguing to me. There is, without doubt, the narcissism we see in serial killers. That is something that we all accept. We recognise that these individuals have this superiority and arrogance, and they feel that they wish to be part of something that they've created, even though, should they be found out, the consequences would be dire for them. And yet, so often we see them unable to deal with the tantalizing experience of tapping in, of nudging the investigators in their own direction. It's almost as if they can't handle not being involved in a chase. Maybe that's the key, that they believe they're better than the authorities, but how could they know without allowing them a little chink in the armor of their own? They like to believe that they want to believe that they can outsmart the authorities, that they're better than them. So they create a little chink in their own armor, just a tiny spot where light can shine onto their identity. And they hope that they're right and that they can outsmart these authorities, but often it's their downfall. We see that with Dennis Rader and the floppy disk that he sent in. These are moments where it's as if Mother Nature that's created these killers has created them to be almost perfect human predators. But she's just caused a little chink in their armor, the arrogance that means that eventually, even if they are natural born killers, they will essentially show themselves to be exactly who they are to those who can eventually stop them. There are other theories, of course, that somewhere within the echoes of their mind, there is a conscience that tries to get through, that leaves traces and trails so that eventually that breadcrumb trail can lead back to that individual and they can be brought to justice. It could be that within their mind, there is this tiny part that says, you are broken, you are wrong, you must be stopped. We can't evidence which way that is, but they're interesting to consider when we think about these kind of pieces of information literally being sent by the very person who would ideally wish to be left to their own devices to carry on killing. So they look at this map, they look at this letter. First of all, there's no prints on it, no DNA. So forensically, this person's been effective. Meanwhile, as well, the borders have actually been cut off the map. So they're making sure, as far as they're concerned, that there's no way that they're going to be able to trace this map and then figure out who downloaded it and consequently figure out who they are. But you can't send something like this to the authorities without instantly having the incredible technological departments that look at computers and imagery, who are so unbelievably qualified in this, that when they're offered this kind of a thing, well, it's a piece of a puzzle. And these individuals who work in these departments, who trace these kind of things back to the root, they are obsessed with finding the piece of that puzzle. They want the solution. So they find out that it's been downloaded from Expedia.com. Investigators, they just contact Expedia. And they advise that Microsoft provided the information for its map sites. So at this point, the FBI get a subpoena, which means that you don't have a choice but to give the information. For those of you who don't know what a subpoena is, I have in fact had my own notes on two cases subpoenaed to court. So you do have to, therefore, unless you want to be in contempt, hand them over. So they request these records from Microsoft of any maps of West Alton, basically made between the 18th and 21st of May 2002. So that's the period that covers the news article in the press and the date that's postmarked on the envelope that they believe has been sent by the killer. 2 weeks later, just 2 weeks, which is really effective, isn't it? I mean, I don't know about you. I am struggling to even get an appointment with my general practitioner within, I don't know, 7 months. Hi, could I have an appointment? I'm not feeling very well. How ill are you feeling? I'm not feeling very well. Are you feeling so unwell that you might not make it? And I don't think I'm not gonna make it. I just feel really under the weather. Do you have a cold? I mean, I do have a few symptoms. Don't come anywhere near us with a cold. You're not allowed in with a cold. We don't want anybody near us if you could have a cold. Go away. Okay, I don't, maybe a stomach ache. A stomach ache. We cover stomach aches. How long can you wait? Well, I'd like to come quite soon because my stomach aches quite a lot. No problem. It's, where are we now? October. We can see you February the 3rd, 2023. I think I might be all right then. Well, brilliant. You're cured. Sorry, just throwing out there. That's how it feels. So 2 weeks. It's not a long time, is it, at the moment? And certainly back in the day, we're talking about a period of time where technology was nowhere near where it was at now, and they only take 2 weeks to do this. So investigators receive amazing news. So they're able to actually discover, and this is, as far as I'm concerned, pretty incredible. I know technology can be used for good, I know it can be used for bad, but this is certainly what I see is the benefit of technology when it comes down to these kinds of investigations, because literally they find out that only one computer had actually created and downloaded that map during the period, on the 20th of May, in fact. And it exactly mapped the map that had been sent with a letter. So, of course, from that, they're able to find the IP address. That's the internet protocol. That's what IP means. Sorry, have I just become some kind of technological geek? No, I just looked it up because I wanted to sound good. But yeah, internet protocol is the IP address, and that was 65227-10678. So they track it back. Now, to people like me, that, until I understood what IPs were, could have just been seen as like a stream of random numbers. But to experts, it's quite the contrary. It's basically a digital fingerprint. And that means that they can literally trace it back to the person who created it. Now, the first set of those numbers, that identifies the network that the computer belongs to. But the rest, that literally identifies the computer itself. So at this point, the FBI utilize the services of WorldCom Incorporated. So it's a company that basically connects internet services to the dial-up customers. And on the 4th of June 2002, the username was identified. And that username was identified as MSN Maury Travis. The FBI at this point then cross-references with the Microsoft records, and they're able to identify their prime suspect's name, address, and even his telephone number. It was 36-year-old hotel waiter Maury Troy Travis from Ferguson, Missouri. and that man was still on parole for a previous robbery, and he even had a history of drug abuse. Furthermore, guess what? It was established that, oh, what a surprise, the killings had literally stopped during the time that he'd been taken back into prison for breaching his parole. As far as they are concerned, they have their man banged to rights, don't they? And actually, if they needed more, shall we say, I don't know, I'm feeling like the case is pretty strong. I'm feeling like we don't really need any more evidence, but let's just throw it in for good measure. Okay, you do that then. 4th of July the previous year, a naked sex worker had literally been seen running and screaming from his property. Now, he was charged with assault for this, but classic, he just said that she tried to rob him. And ultimately, the woman chose not to press charges. Now, there were lots of different levels to that. First of all, I'm just going to throw it out there. If I was trying to rob a man, throwing it out there, I'm a sex worker. I've gone to his place to, I don't know, make some money. So I'm going to be expecting some money. But then I'm going to somehow change this situation up, take control and steal from him. Ask me this. Riddle me this. Why would she be running naked screaming from his home? That is not what you do when you are robbing somebody. Ever. Never. Doesn't happen. That's what you do when you're fearful for your life, isn't it? Simple as that. That classic old adage of, oh, you know, I just procured her to my home. She's a sex worker. She tried to steal from me and then she just ran out of the house screaming when I challenged her, which I imagine is where he'd have gone with it. Does not make sense. Also, very common for sex workers to literally not want to be involved in the system. They don't want to have to appear in court because they get a really bad time a lot of the time. Because people are not nice to people that they feel that they're in a superior position where they can judge them for. So it does not register for me that somehow, just because of this, he doesn't get charges by the state. I think there was a lot of room there to do that. She was obviously completely unaware at this moment in time that she literally has escaped with her life. She escaped the clutches of a serial killer. On the 7th of June, this is 2002, 7 a.m. in the morning, St. Louis officers, well, they've got a search warrant. They arrive at Travis's property and he's asleep at the time. Of course, it's 7 a.m. in the morning. Now, when detectives came face to face with him, they were really surprised. He was not in there. I don't know, stereotype textbook of what does a serial killer look like when you go and arrest them. Yeah, they obviously felt that he was going to look like some kind of monster. But, you know, as they put it, he just seemed like a regular guy with a really acceptable demeanour. Now, when he asked them, can you explain, officers, why you're at my home so early? The detective said, you know why. Travis agreed. He did know why. Now, inside his property, even though we're in that situation where there's this weird acceptance that both parties know why they are there, this demeanor continues. This regular kind of guy, personality, nothing standing out, nothing shouting, serial killer. And they're looking around and it just doesn't make sense. Initially, of course, it will make sense shortly, but initially. But then, of course, as they're looking around this regular place, turns out it's not regular at all. Because what people didn't know about Travis, the quiet guy who, quote, they often saw washing his car. I don't know about you, but I am going to throw it out there now. We all appreciate that an individual who either keeps a tidy home in a regular fashion or regularly washes his cars is without doubt not an individual that could carry out any type of crime. Only reckless and tidy individuals would be capable of such gross misdemeanours. I do love the way that people describe individuals who genuinely are these monsters, and it's like they've got this idea that they could never look after anything within their property. But that's how they describe him. What they don't know is that this same neighbour who likes washing his car has a massive obsession with a very particular sexual paraphernalia. So he's a sadist. And that means that he gains sexual satisfaction basically from inflicting pain and suffering on others. I appreciate that for those of you who may be involved in the BDSM community, which is a consenting community, and where mutual gratification takes place and both parties consent, we are in a different world to what I'm talking about right now. Because we're talking about a sexual sadist who does not wish to have on the whole a consenting partner whatsoever. And where there is no safe word, there is no stopping. There is only one party gaining from this interaction. And when it comes down to Travis, not only is he a sexual sadist, he's an individual who's taken it to a level that no one in their worst nightmares could have ever conceived or imagined. So why don't we take a moment to just look at who Travis was, like what formed him, what was his childhood like, etc. So he's born on the 25th of October, 1965. His mum is Sandra and his dad is Michael. And he basically is known by a nickname, Toby. So he lives with the family in Carr Square. It's a public housing complex in St. Louis, Missouri. And what can I say when I look into the background of this particular killer? Well, I suppose for me, the most interesting aspect about it all is how unremarkable his childhood seems to have been. So he was, without doubt, a very withdrawn and quiet child, but equally he was considered incredibly polite, very respectful. Adults who knew him felt that he was somebody who was very aware of etiquette and knew how to behave. One teacher actually recalled that he was an incredibly quiet for a teenager. He mowed his neighbour's lawn. He behaved at school. Nothing stood out there. And people who knew him, and I'm talking about teachers, I'm talking about parents, friends, I'm talking about people who knew him per se, they did not think he was capable of hurting anyone. And when the police actually spoke to people who'd gone to school with Travis or people who actually lived near him, many of them didn't even know who he was. He just didn't stand out. So we can say, well, evidently that means that he's somebody who's more comfortable blending into the background. Arguably that could be more effective for a chameleon. If you don't stand out, people don't take note of you. So therefore, you're not going to be the first person that comes to mind when bad things happen. But then this childhood has, I suppose, a change when the family moved to Ferguson, Missouri. That's when he's 10. And then 3 years after they've moved there, his parents do actually divorce. And this is when he's 13. So again, we could say, well, that's a level of trauma. But it's also very common these days that parents divorce. He then graduates high school, 1985. And then he serves 2 years as an army reservist. And he works as a medical and dental assistant. He also manages to secure employment locally with haulage companies, even volunteers at a local nursing home. I guess the reason I'm describing that is when we often do tales regarding serial killers, we punctuate a lot of the childhood with quite traumatic realities that they've endured. This is not something that stands out in this particular man's childhood. And even though, again, when you're an organised serial killer, you wear the overalls and masks that you can of an ordinary human being who fits in, therefore things like volunteering would certainly help because people think you're a decent human being and so on and so forth. To some degree, it is clear that nobody believed this man was capable of this horrific harm. He seems to have his life together. At least at this point, it seems to be a relatively productive member of society. But of course, it doesn't carry on because things start to go downhill. And they start to go downhill in 1987. Now, at this point, he's 22. And he enrolls in a private college in Atlanta, which should be a good thing. Sadly, it's also where he meets and forms a relationship with cocaine. And this is when his life just starts to spiral out of control. And at one point, the addiction was costing him $300 a day. That is a hell of a lot of cocaine to be taking. And if you have a dependency issue of that level, unless you are incredibly wealthy, in which case it's not a problem. I think you can just put in pictures of various individuals in celebrity A-list spheres who can all take what they like on a day, but they've got £50 million in the bank, so it's not really that much of an issue. But for us mere mortals, $300 a day is a huge amount of money, and if you ain't in the film industry, you ain't a billionaire, you're gonna have to fund it somehow. So he does. And he starts having to get involved in criminal acts. It's the only way he can feed his habit. So the following year, after he's formed his habit, Travis is basically on the police radar. This is for the first time. Now, bear in mind that prior to this, he hasn't actually offended. All we could say is, Travis, you didn't gently escalate your offending. You just went straight in there, didn't you? You were like, I could just shoplift. I could, I don't know, write some false checks. I could do the things that we expect to see in offending behaviour, because we don't imagine that the first crime that they're going to do is to, whilst on spring break from college, rob 5 shoe stores in St. Louis. Yeah, over an 8-day period in March 1988. So he didn't actually have a loaded weapon. He took in a plastic toy gun. Clearly, that's terrifying for anybody who's in the store, because you would not know that that was not real. So he literally does armed robberies. They are the first that he's captured for, and it doesn't seem that he's done anything before. Now, he's apprehended because witnesses are able to give police a description of his car. And the detective who actually arrests him is really surprised by the kind of person he is. He expects Travis to be a different type of person, and in fact he refers to Travis this way. He says he was respectful and quiet and reserved. He wasn't your typical type of criminal. Now, he told the police when he's arrested that he really had very little recollection of any of the crimes that he'd carried out, and this was as far as he was concerned to do with the fact that he was under the influence of drugs. So he felt like he was in an altered state of consciousness. Whilst he's awaiting sentence, he goes on a drug rehab program. And according to Travis, this is when he managed to get himself clean. But in spite of this, and this is important, of course it is, when we think about people, prior behaviour, mitigating circumstances, this individual had not been involved in criminal acts. Yes, it was awful what he'd done, but he hadn't actually taken a loaded weapon into the stores, so therefore he wasn't intending to actually hurt people. And subsequently, he'd also gone on a course where he'd got his life together regarding drug management and rehabilitation. So when it gets to court, these are things that tend to be considered. And he also got loads and loads of character references in support of him, probably including a neighbour who said, Travis is a good man. He is always cleaning his car. But a lot of these were pretty powerful. And one of these references is even from a congressman and US representative. So they're pretty powerful. Now, even though the judge acknowledged that his offending behavior had definitely been an aberration in his character, he still gets sentenced to 15 years imprisonment on July the 5th, 1989. That's a pretty long sentence. Don't get me wrong, armed robbery is a terrible, terrible crime, and the impact that you have on those who feel that their life is at risk is huge, without a doubt. But again, 15 years, that might have been considered steep. He's only 23 at the time, no offending behaviour. Clearly, we all know, because I'm talking about him in this way, it would have been better if it had been 300 years, but just taking it in the context of what it was. Now, Travis knew from the get-go it was not going to be okay for him in prison. And he actually writes to the judge begging him, and I mean begging him, to reconsider his sentence. And it read, daily and hourly and also at any given moment, I think of taking my life. The condition here are excruciatingly tormenting, to say the least. Staying in my cell and crying myself to sleep most every night will not help. But it's so very hard to believe this has happened to me. The whole situation is horrid and fantastic. If it weren't for such a caring cellmate, I'm very sure I'd have committed suicide after my very first day here at this institution. You, sir, are my last hope. Please give me another chance in society. Please. He also claimed that the conditions there were really inhospitable. They were awful. There were frequent sexual assaults. Also, he said that the place was rife with drugs, which was terrible for his rehabilitation because he'd got his dependency issues under control and now he was faced with drugs everywhere. And we all agree that's not great for a former addict. So, of course, when the judge gets his letter, I mean, it's really compelling. He's given 15 years to this guy and he's reading it and he's considering the reality and he's thinking to himself, you know, 15 years, wow, this guy is going to struggle for 15 years because at the end of the day, he's only carried out several armed robberies. Yes, it wasn't actually with a gun that was real, but it was several armed robberies, terrifying many, many people. But at the end of the day, he does sound really sorry. And 15 years is completely contextual when you consider armed robberies and the impact. Completely contextual. Some people get like 40 years. I've read this. I'm feeling totally justified. I'm burning the letter. Moving on. He's what? He's stolen 15 sandwiches from 13 shops over 2 days. 23 years. And another 5, because I don't like his face. Just saying. It was completely contextual, wasn't it?
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At the end of the day, even though there were mitigation circumstances, it's going to fall on deaf ears because the judge knows the reality. He really had carried out crimes that caused huge issues for those who were victims. Now, Travis does get paroled. This is in 1994, and he only serves 5 years and 3 months of his sentence inside. Now, a lot of that comes down to the fact that genuinely he was really well behaved. He was what was considered a model prisoner to some degree. Yeah, he had 13 conduct violations, but they weren't big violations at all. So when he's released, he's moved into a duplex and neighbours say, really good neighbour, didn't cause any problems. They literally had no disturbances whatsoever from that property. Literally, when I say no one, and I've looked to find whether anybody said nasty things about him and were like, I know. Because there's usually that person, isn't there? There's usually that person in these crimes where everybody's like, I would totally have believed that I wanted my daughter to marry him. And the vicar's like, he came to church every week. He helped with the flower arranging. And then there's that one person and they're like, I knew he was a wrong un. I looked at his face one day and I saw that one of those eyes looked a little bit stranger than the other eye and I thought, serial killer. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, not in this case. In fact, a woman whose daughter actually dated this man described him, quote, as a laid back and happy man, as a perfect gentleman. Now, Travis does go back to prison a couple of times and both of those are for drug related charges. And because of that, he's always in breach of his parole conditions because obviously he can't take drugs whilst on parole. Now, when he's not in prison, he just works at various restaurants. And when he wasn't working, he basically kept himself to himself. There is one thing that people noted about him in particular. He had this fixation with his car. It was a real pride and joy for him. His car was a year 2000 black Mitsubishi Eclipse, and he apparently spent hours cleaning it, hours maintaining it. Now, according to a co-worker of Travis, he actually told them that he knew of a car that had been stolen that was later found ablaze in East St. Louis. At the same time that he was having this discussion, he actually told that co-worker that that area was a really good place to dump things. And the reason for this, as far as he was concerned, is that there aren't many police around. Now, police members had actually been severely cut in that area. Also, the area itself was really overgrown, lots of weeds, lots of abandoned buildings. There were loads of rubbish piles there. And when you think that he's telling that co-worker that, it makes sense that four of the bodies that I've talked about, four of those suspected victims of Travis, were actually found in that area. Meanwhile, as well, he'd actually told the co-worker's girlfriend about bodies of prostitutes that were being dumped around the area. Now, this co-worker's girlfriend actually worked for a TV network at the time. And Travis kind of tells her, because we know they like to talk about their crimes, don't they? But he doesn't want to implicate himself. So he suggests that a friend of his has mentioned the killings. And what sticks in this woman's mind at the time, working for a news network, is that he uses the term serial killer and it sparks her interest. So she hasn't heard about this. She works in the news. She thinks it's a potential scoop. So she goes to the bosses. There's a serial killer around. They look into it. At the point where he tells her that, there's no information about any of these alleged killings. It's only after Travis actually gets arrested that she puts two and two together and realises he's given her information that no one else was aware of. He's given her information that indeed a serial killer is on the loose killing sex workers. But the reason he's telling her that, the reason he knows it, is because he's the serial killer. Again, imagine that moment where she just realises she was literally being informed by the man who'd murdered these women. And she's just not seeing that he is the individual responsible. Of course she isn't. So back to the search of Travis's home. Investigators who think he's just this regular guy who is surprised by his calm demeanor, what do they find? Well, they find a converted basement, first of all. It's been made into a sex torture dungeon. And okay, you know, if that's for consenting people, as long as it's consenting, as long as it's enjoyable, knock yourself out. Not gonna lie, I am quite a liberal person. If I were to go around a mate's house and they were like, hey, do you want to like look around? I've got a new home and this is my lounge, this is my dining room, this is my kitchen, these are my bedrooms, I'll look downstairs, this is my sex dungeon. I would be like, left my gas on and it's really expensive. I'll be back in, just bye. I don't want to see that stuff. It scares me. But basically, that's what they find. And between March 2001 and May 2002, during this period, this is when Travis has literally been picking up sex workers along a strip of Broadway. This is north of St. Louis, and it's called the Stroll. And that area itself is known because it's got loads of crack houses. It's got loads of sex workers available. And so this is where he procures them. Then he takes them back to his home in Ferguson. He keeps some of them for days, just torturing them. But it isn't simply that he's torturing them for his pleasure alone. He's recording what's taking place in the basement. Police found videotapes. They were hidden in a wall. And in some of the clips, Travis does have consensual sex with the women. It's rough, it's bondage sex. Also, he's often seen taking drugs with women as well, smoking crack. But on these occasions, he actually lets them go unharmed. However, in others, he followed a far more sinister path. And there was evidence he was actually making snuff movies. The officers found it difficult to understand initially, like, why is he choosing this sex worker over this sex worker? Why is this sex worker getting to go home? Why is this sex worker being paid for her services and surviving, and this person is being murdered? And they believe that the trigger seemed to have been a discovery that the sex worker had children. It seems that that was his reasoning for the violent rage that he'd get into. I mean, it's not confirmed, but that's the link that they've made. I mean, whatever the motive, he made them perform the most unbelievable rituals. It was so bizarre. So he'd get them to dance in white clothes. I immediately think of him placing them in white, a symbol of purity. Think about white wedding dresses. It's virgin-like. Also, sacrificial outfits have often in the past been white. So there were all these potential psychological links for me as to why he would dress them in those particular colours. Then at times he'd get them to wear sunglasses where the lenses were completely blackened so they couldn't see. So he's taking the power away from them completely. And then he would restrain them. And he'd use rope, he'd use handcuffs, cover their eyes with duct tape, which must just have been absolutely terrifying. Duct tape is one of those things that it's so wide and powerful and strong, and there's so little you can do when somebody uses it on you. And to have your eyes literally completely without the opportunity to see any light whatsoever. I mean, talk about stealing the life force of a human being. Literally blackening out every part of their visual sense. The footage that they found saw these women shackled basically to a wooden post, and then he'd just verbally taunt them, tell them what was going to happen. Or then he'd berate them as well at times. He'd get really angry because of the fact that he'd found out these women had children, and he's actually criticizing them, aggressing them, violating them because of the fact that, as far as he is concerned, they've chosen drugs over the kids. Bear in mind, this is the same man who went to prison for doing armed robberies because he chose dependency over his freedom. Little bit of contradiction, hypocrisy there, but you know our serial killers, they're full of it, aren't they? Maybe those women in this moment represent the rage that he feels for a part of himself that he knows is not the success that he believes it should have been. So therefore he projects all of that onto who they are. He can judge them as opposed to judging himself. He can use them to aggress, to use this diabolical area of his nature and to feel validated because, as far as he is concerned, at least he has a house, he has a job. These are sex workers who've given in completely to their addiction to the point where they've given their kids away and so on and so forth. So he uses this as a reasoning, a logic, an excuse to go ahead and kill. Imagine this man berating you whilst killing you because you've chosen drugs over your kids. You've chosen murder over morality, Travis. I mean, literally, welcome to the warped world of a serial killer's mind. The interaction between Travis and one unidentified victim went as follows. You want to say something to your kids? Mama, sorry. Who's raising your kids? Me, my mum and dad. You ain't raising shit, bitch. You're over here on your back, smoking crack. You ain't going home tomorrow. I'm keeping you about a week, is that all right? He forced another victim to repeatedly say to him, you are the master. It pleases me to serve you. And he shouted at her when she stopped. And in the most disturbing piece of footage, Travis is actually seen standing over a kneeling, naked woman, heavily bound with rope and handcuffed. And then he suddenly grabs the bell. He snaps it tightly around her neck and he strangles her until she's unconscious and she's limp. He may even have broken her neck. Then he just leaves her body face down on the floor and he states, "This is first kill, number one." First kill was 19 years old. Name? I don't know. I don't give an F. First kill was nice. Now, whilst police never actually got to identify who that woman was, or even know for sure, absolutely, that she'd been killed, let's be honest, the video evidence seems pretty damn conclusive. There's another videotape, and it was labelled Your Wedding Day. Like I said, I think the white, the pure that he's dressing the girls in, I think there's some kind of a fantasy there of taking a woman who's pure and then deriding her, humiliating her, desecrating her body was a fantasy that he was really interested in. That was something that really got him off. So that particular video starts off with a wedding ceremony, but then the footage just changes and it's loads of women being taunted, raped and strangled by Travis. They were also violated with foreign objects. And the officers who actually had to watch that footage, who had to endure that imagery, that video, they all had to be given psychological counselling afterwards because they were all so traumatised by it. And these are dyed-in-the-wool officers. They've seen murder scenes. They've been involved in scenarios where you and I would not wish to be, we would not wish to see, and they were literally broken by these images, by these videos. That's how graphic and grotesque they were. Because again, I'm always gonna bring it back to the reality. They were seeing real human beings being horribly murdered, horribly tortured, horribly taunted by this man that they had misguidedly trusted, followed, believed was going to pay them for their services. Now, unbelievably, today, only one woman has actually been identified from those that were captured on film, and that's 46-year-old Betty James. Now, her actual killing wasn't filmed, but she was found murdered on the 23rd of May 2001 in St. Louis. And in some instances, Travis had actually forced the victims to state their names on camera. But often these were street workers, sex workers. They didn't want to give their real names, so they'd often use a street alias, which is problematic, of course, because that meant that they didn't directly, as officers, know who they were when these individuals turned up on film. Because if they hadn't been reported missing, if bodies hadn't been identified and linked to them, the consequences are that those women are basically Jane Doe's on film. When they found this torture chamber basement, they also started to find so much forensic evidence. I mean, loads. So it turns out, first of all, the basement walls were literally covered in blood. So each time Travis had had somebody in the basement and murdered them and blood had splattered up over the walls, he'd just repaint them. It was just his way of hiding the evidence. And they could tell that there was layer after layer of paint there. So it was clear that there'd been many instances of victims being just brutally attacked, brutally killed, and then he just covered it up. The belts, ligatures, also discovered, and they were actually locked in a filing cabinet. Again, these were all smeared in blood. This guy didn't think he was gonna get caught. And then on top of that, there was semen that was found in two of the victims, as I said earlier on. They were both a match for Travis's DNA. And on top of that, the tire mark I told you about earlier on, the one that was left on Betty James's leg, yeah, that matched Travis's Mitsubishi Eclipse car, his much-loved vehicle. So suddenly, if they needed any more of this information to attach this monster to these crimes, they had everything they could possibly need, and he's completely banged to rights. There is no way this guy is going to have any wriggle room to get out of this. They also seized computer equipment and technology from his home, so they were able to take in the computer that he'd used, the one that had been the absolute connection with this crime. So that was what had led to him being apprehended. They also found newspaper clippings about the 17 victims that Travis had claimed to have killed. They were also in the basement. So as far as I'm concerned, that is a direct link. We know what serial killers like to do. These mementos, these anchors to the moment of the murders, they collect them psychologically so they can revisit and relive them. They like knowing that they're the individual that stole the life of those human beings that they murdered. They also turned up a stun gun, found loads of bondage equipment. So now Travis is arrested on suspicion, of course, of murder, but he's also actually charged with two federal kidnapping counts. And the reason for that is he allegedly took two of his victims, that was Betty James and Ellison Greenwade, across state lines. Now, when the police, who were already blindsided by this average guy turning out to be this serial killer, they look into his background, of course. They want to see a dysfunctional childhood, because we see that often with serial killers. Abusive parents, animal abuse, arson. But investigators turned up nothing. Nothing that hinted at him being a future violent offender. There were no episodes of trauma in his life that were so huge that it could be a catalyst for the killings. The FBI agents who actually questioned Travis in his home, they said he was relatively uncooperative, but he didn't seem nervous at all. Didn't seem intimidated. In fact, one of the things that they noted that was disconcerting was the fact that he displayed this real desire to be in control. So he would redirect any questions asked back at agents. So they'd say, "What did you do as a child?" And he'd go, "Nothing. Went to school. What did you do?" He even tried to control where the agent sat. They also said that he was really displeased when they petted his cat, because one of the officers picked it up. Now, personally, the fact that he is displeased at that action interests me, because immediately I'm drawn to feel that the cat is property and Travis does not like somebody else handling his property. We know how he is about his car. I imagine his cat is of a similar ilk. It's his. He doesn't want one of these officers feeling that he has any right to touch it. That's just my own thoughts. I may be completely wrong. I'm just throwing it in there. So there's this 2-hour conversation, of course, because this is a really serious situation. And they're at his home trying to draw out the information before they charge him and so on and so forth. But you would imagine, I'm just going to say, if I were Travis and, I don't know, FBI had turned up, I would first of all be like, why are you here? Why are you here? You know, that would be it, wouldn't it? Why are you here? Why are you in my house? Why are you touching my cat? At the end of the day, I would have questions. What did my children do? What did my husband do? What did my mum do? I would want to know. During that entire 2-hour conversation, he doesn't once ask why they're there. Doesn't once ask. What he does ask, however, is how they traced him. The arrogance is unbelievable, isn't it? These narcissists, they can't help in those moments just implicate themselves because of their arrogance. The bit that he cannot manage is that he's not outsmarted these officers. He believed that he had it figured. He believed he'd done it safely when he got in contact with the reporter, and now he wants to know how the hell he screwed up, because he thought he'd nailed it. And when he's told it was the map, he was just really angry. He was really frustrated, and he stated, "Effing computer, damned internet." That's what really got him. Forget the reality of what we're talking about here and these women who've been ruined by this predator in our society. All he cares about is that somehow he made a mistake. He's not a perfect 10. Then the agents show him pictures of women and they ask him, "Do you recognize any of these women?" And he says, "No." But then he asks to see the pictures of the dead girls again. except the agent hadn't said the girls in the pictures were dead. He hadn't mentioned at all that any of the women were dead. That slip. He knows they're dead because he killed them. But the agent had carefully intended to make it clear that he wasn't suggesting that any of these women had been murdered, just showing them pictures. And Travis falls into that trap. But the fact that Travis wants to look again, that's not because he's about to admit it in that moment. That's almost his swan song of serial killing. He wants to look at the pictures of the women's whose lives he snuffed out. That's why. Psychologically, he wants to look into their eyes again. He's doing that because he's reliving. He's connecting. On the way to the station, Travis, literally out of the blue, offers to take the agents to another body. Yeah, tells them drive to East St. Louis. But then, as they near East St. Louis, he just changes his mind, tells them to take him to jail. What's he doing that? He's asserting his power. It's been taken from him, so now he wants to feel like he has some kind of control. He's titillating them. He's dangling the carrot. He's saying, I know more. And then he's taking that away. He's trying to assert himself in those moments. Now, during the police interrogation, a little bit like the questioning at home, he's very uncooperative. He makes it clear, however, what he felt like about the women that he'd murdered. He said they weren't victims. In fact, he says that he believed that prostitutes were the lowest of the low. He does admit that he paid the sex workers for sex, but he was unwilling to admit anything else. However, there is something that Travis engages with, and that's when one of the investigators actually poses a question as to whether Travis, who's committed these crimes, had done it because he'd either learnt how to do that, so it had been a learned behaviour, maybe from his upbringing experiences, what he'd seen elsewhere, or whether it was an inherent behaviour, i.e. was it within him? And Travis actually stated to him, you wouldn't understand. And he said, he was born like this. They'd been like this for as long as he could remember. So he's literally saying, it is a part of who I am. Since my earliest memories, this knowledge, this desire to kill, it's existed within me. When the police tell Travis that they found all this incriminating evidence in his basement, Travis says, I knew you'd find it. And he actually told the investigators, I'm toast. I'm toast. I would agree. You certainly are not going to be walking away from this situation effectively, Travis. You are a serial killer. I don't know whether the word toast is appropriate. Unless, however, we were going to put him in the electric chair, in which case cooking does come into it. But toast doesn't seem to be, shall I say, strong enough to describe the reality of what we're talking about. I'm toast. I think you're a bit worse than that, mate. I think you're a bit worse than that. So he gets questioned for a total of about 8 hours, doesn't show any remorse, confesses to nothing. And after a period of time, after this 8 hours, he just stops communicating completely, and he even requests a lawyer, so the interview is stopped. As far as he is concerned, he's got control again. He knows that he's allowed a lawyer whenever he asks for one. He knows that he's not going to give any information to these investigators because, hey, he might have lost control of his freedom, but he doesn't have to lose control over his knowledge. He doesn't have to lose control over hoarding, keeping, commanding the information that the police need. So Travis then gets remanded at St. Louis County Jail, and understandably they put him on suicide watch. That's a good idea. Offenders like this who have struggled prior in prison and also are dealing with, shall we say, ultimately a crime that could lead to them never walking the streets again or being put to death, that is going to be emotionally troubling. And Suicide Watch is a way of trying to maintain the person's life to ensure that they can ultimately face the penalty that they deserve. Because people deserve to go to court for these things. Trials need to happen. Families need to get a level of justice and closure. So the officer is basically permanently placed outside his cell door. And one of the reasons for this as well is because he's actually told the interrogators that he's not going to go back to prison. In spite of this plan, which should have been effective, I don't know. He was on suicide watch. I'm going to break down what that should mean. We're only 3 days after him being put on remand. I'm going to throw it out there that suicide watch would mean that you were watching somebody. So I don't know. They couldn't take their own life. Just imagining that that would be why it's called suicide watch. Also, officer permanently outside his cell door, I would throw in my assertion here would be correct. That there could be no possibility of suicide. Yeah? And yet, 3 days, like I say, after he's been on remand, on the 10th of June 2002, he's found dead in his cell. Apparently he'd taken the opportunity during the shower break and he'd managed, bear in mind, he's meant to be on suicide watch with an officer outside his door permanently, but somehow, in spite of that, he's stuffed toilet paper into his nostrils. He's put a gag in his mouth, pillowcases over his head, tied bedcloths around his neck, threaded other end of those bedsheets through the vent, bound his hands, and stepped off his toilet. I am not going to pretend for a minute that I will mourn this man's life, but I do worry that he was meant to be on suicide watch, and I have just described a relatively elaborate way of killing oneself that would take more than a moment. Simple as. Yeah, he manages to do this. Now, the authorities later conclude that part of this is to do with the fact that he had so much knowledge about bondage, so he knew how to bind his own hands behind his back. They did also find a suicide note, which again states it's intentional that he wanted to take his life, although I don't think we needed a suicide note to validate it was in.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Intentional. It was a pretty unusual way of killing oneself, and it was elaborate, if nothing else. However, suicide note, always good to figure out what was going on in this kind of individual's mind as they take their own life. You know, remorse is always a good one, isn't it? Apologies to God, to society, to the victims, to his own family, and so on and so forth. They're expected because the person is contemplating their end and therefore considering their actions. And I don't know how that may impact on their next life. If, for example, they're a Buddhist, maybe they would come back as a pebble. And then they'd have to work their way all the way through until they got another chance to be a human. If, however, they were a Christian, repent, or it's down the lift for you to the burning flames of hell. Just saying, you know where I'm going with it. So let's look at his suicide note. Yeah, he apologised for any pain caused to his mother. That's literally what it said. Sorry? Just, what was that? Read me his note again. Just, I want to hear it. I want to check this out. Let me know what was in the note. Right, he says he wants to apologise for any pain he's caused his mother. Is there another paragraph? Is there another paragraph? There's no other paragraph. It's just specifically that. Have you looked on the back? Because it could be on the back. It's definitely not on the back. Have you checked the envelope to make sure, or behind the desk, or somewhere in the vicinity of where the letter was? It didn't have an envelope, and we've checked everywhere forensically. Just an apology to his mother. I despair. Even when he's taking his own life, he didn't really feel any remorse whatsoever. He made no mention of apologies to his victims. No apology to the victims' families. And it also actually stated that he would sooner take his own life than be executed or spend his life in prison. I guess what we could say is, like a lot of killers, think about Israel Keyes, another serial killer that I've covered, they like to stay in control right until the end. And that's what we're seeing here. I do feel he's made an error though, because even though he won't be executed by the state, he did execute himself. Secondly, yes, he won't be in prison because of that, but the suggestion there that he's just going to have ended keeps me warm that I don't have that belief system. I think Judgment Day was a coming for him, and I would not have wanted to be there. That's all I'm saying. It's worth noting at this point as well that even though he's killed himself, the authorities are still left with some very questionable things to answer. First of all, they had to admit that they'd had a serial killer on their hands who'd likely killed 17 women, even though they hadn't even been close to catching one. The only reason that they found him was because of that reporter. Then the prime suspect, with all of the answers, manages to kill himself whilst in police custody, whilst on suicide watch. Which means that, first of all, he takes the truth and the extent of his crimes to the grave. And we also, and this is really important, we lose a really valuable opportunity to understand the mindset of a killer. When we interview these individuals, we learn more. It's a profiling opportunity where we can gain insight. They can help us to prevent further predators striking in this way. We lose that as well. Also, loads of families therefore had no closure. Travis never would face justice. How embarrassing for those authorities. And that all comes down to what I said at the beginning, people not caring enough about sex workers, vagrants, drug dependents who go missing. We need to do more for that. Today, Travis has been positively linked to at least 7 killings. But bear in mind, when he wrote to that journalist, he stated that he killed at least 17. And police actually believe that he may have killed as many as 20 women in the St. Louis and East St. Louis area. Today, only 12 bodies have actually been found, and all of them were drug dependent sex workers. They also suspect that he's responsible for another 3 unsolved murders in the area because the way that the bodies were actually found matched Travis's MO. So they were bound with ropes or handcuffs and they'd been strangled. This also includes 61-year-old Mary Shields. Her body was found on the 31st of July 2000 in East St. Louis. She'd been a really heavy drinker. She was homeless sometimes. And what the police actually believe is that she was Travis's first murder victim. And she wasn't a sex worker, bear in mind. She had been homeless, but she wasn't a sex worker. The police in Atlanta, they also think that he could be behind 6 murders of prostitutes there. They all occurred in 1994. And the reason that they believe that is because Travis was actually living in the city at that time. And 4 of those women have never actually been identified. Now, even though on one level, it makes sense to me that the police and authorities are looking at all of these other women whose bodies have turned up or have gone missing and considering that Travis was responsible, I feel that there is a need for some caution. He said 17. He killed 17. In my experience of the majority of serial killers, they're very proud of their kill count. Why would Travis write to a reporter specifically stating that he killed 17? Why wouldn't he put 24? What's the difference? Certainly he wanted to stake claim to these murders. So we can either listen to the reality of what he's saying, which therefore suggests that there is other serial killers killing women. Yes, they may have a similar MO, but strangulation is often an MO used by serial killers. What worries me is once again to placate our fear, to reject the reality that these predators live amongst us. They want to gather up these women's deaths and pin them on a man that no longer walks the earth, that makes us feel safer, that makes them feel closure. But I don't know whether that makes me feel safe. And if there are still predators living in our society, taking women from those streets, and no one's looking because they've assigned these murders to this man, then once again, we're failing these people, these women. Now, whilst Travis, when we looked at his childhood, we can say was atypical of most serial killers, he definitely fits organized serial offender as an adult, without a doubt. Chameleon-like, completely under the radar, very, very inconspicuous. He was probably one of the most invisible predators that I've learned about. He lived this double life, Jekyll and Hyde. On one hand, really quiet, polite, really nice neighbor. On the other hand, really sadistic killer, torturer, serial killer. And like so many other serial killers, he targeted victims of his own race. Specifically, he chose sex workers and drug addicts because they're easily accessible, they're vulnerable, less chance of detection, their deaths attracted way less publicity than it deserved to. And Travis had this moral superiority and justification for why he killed them. They were prostitutes, they were drug addicts, they deserved to die. He saw them as something less than human, something that was played out in this horrific abuse. And then after killing them, he just discards them like rubbish. But his narcissism, like I said, Mother Nature puts those chinks in their armor and it proves to be his downfall. He didn't feel that the killings were getting the attention they deserved. And that's often the case when sex workers are killed, because some people just believe that getting brutally murdered is an occupational hazard. And I have heard investigators, detectives, police officers the world over literally draw that parallel. Well, what do they expect? Rape is part of a sex worker's job. Being brutalized is a part of their job. Ending up dead, part of their job. No, it's not. Sex is part of their job. End of. Travis also tried, remember, to get the TV network, which his co-worker's girlfriend worked for, to look into the serial killings. This is even before the police had identified that he was on the loose, that a serial killer was about. And when one of the killings actually got covered in the local paper, he couldn't help getting in touch. That narcissism played out. He wanted the world to know it was me. And I'm not just a one-off killer, I'm a serial killer, it's my work. And that's so similar to other serial killers. When you think about Dennis Rader, who I've covered, play that game of cat and mouse with the police. But he wasn't computer savvy. So it all backfired. Like I said, just like BTK. That same similar misfortune just a few years later is exactly what happened. Because you don't realize that you're leaving a digital trail that leads right back to you. And also because Travis had those dark, sadistic desires, you know, he wanted to fulfill that fantasy. That also led to his downfall. It wasn't just enough to kill his victims. No, he wanted to take his time. So he took them home. He wanted to relive it. So he recorded them so he could do that time and time again. He's actually, in fairness, only one of a handful of killers who've videotaped their victims. So this is forensically terrible. You've got an absolute wealth of incriminating evidence that literally is in your home if you do that. And that's what happened to him. If he hadn't have taken his life, he'd have been executed, I think. Otherwise, he would definitely have spent the rest of his life in prison. What's really sad is that as it is, because he did manage to kill himself whilst on suicide watch using a bondage technique that must have taken, I don't know, 20 minutes potentially, but who am I to throw aspersions on the individual out there who just fell asleep? Throwing it out there should never have happened. As it is, we may never know the true body count of Maury Travis, the first serial killer to be caught online. And that is dreadful because, as I said, it brings no closure to those women whose lives were taken and whose families were denied and essentially who never had a chance to get their lives back on the straight and narrow. We forget that. We often imagine these people as sex workers and drug dependents, and that's where the story ends. And it doesn't. So often it doesn't end that way. But they didn't have a chance for their lives to be changed because this man stole them from their families, from society. One of the things that I found out during my research that I wanted to put at the end is when you move into a home, you often ask, what has this house been like? Are there nice neighbours? In fact, there are clauses in the UK that if you're not telling the truth about your neighbours and they turn out to be, I don't know, problematic, they might have had the police out a lot, they might have had a bit of a feud with you, and then you just move on and you've not informed them, you might have to buy your house back. That's how serious it is. There are clauses legally in there. You have to be honest about your home. It's a good thing in the UK. Anyway, didn't quite work out for Katrina McGaw. Katrina McGaw rented this place, thought, brilliant. It's great. I like it. It's spacious. There's room potentially to grow. I like this home. And she's kicking back on a sofa one night. She's enjoying her experience of living in this abode. And she's watching a documentary. She's watching a documentary on Maury Travis. And as she's watching the documentary, she's like, this is a good documentary. This is a terrifying thing. This is terrifying. These kind of things are awful. This should not happen. This man is an abomination. This kind of a man is an insult to nature. This kind of a man. That looks very familiar. That's literally my front room. That's my outside. That's my basement. Literally happened. She moved in, rented the place off Travis's mother. Didn't get told. She found out whilst watching a documentary that her home was, I don't know, let's throw it in, murder house. Then, understandably horrified, because who wants to be in a home like that? Knock it down. She tries to get out of the contract. And his mother said, no. I'm going to just say this to end. Whilst I cannot emphatically and scientifically demonstrate an evidence that there was anything wrong with Travis's DNA, I'll just leave you on the note that when this poor woman who moved into a home where women were violated and videoed as they had their lives ended, and she discovered this, as opposed to being freed from her contract, his mother made her stay in it. Maybe there was a bit of dodgy DNA after all. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.